Too often, political reporting tells us how voters feel, but not why they feel that way. This week on our podcast, we're featuring an episode from a series by the WNYC News team called The United States of Anxiety. This episode examines the role the conservative media has played in nurturing the anxiety of many who plan to vote for Trump.
Yes, the Donald has scored!
I got to use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her. Make me a soap star.
How about a little hug for the Donald? He just got off the bus.
Like
okay,
hug,
absolutely.
God bless the United States of
anxiety.
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 I'm Kai Wright, and this is The United States of Anxiety, a podcast from The Nation magazine and WNYC studios. And this week, we have to pause and deal with the disturbing places the Trump campaign has taken us. So let me just be clear. We're reporting some very ugly but very real stuff in this episode, and it may not be appropriate for all audiences. Okay, so after this past week, I'm having trouble with the premise of our podcast. So I think we should tease that out a bit more. What exactly is it we're doing here? At its most basic, we're trying to understand why so many millions of people have been so deeply enthusiastic about Donald Trump, a man who's promising to break up the old order, but with few specifics about what the new order will look like. Because whatever you think of Donald Trump's message, it's not like it came out of thin air. Whatever he's tapped into, it has been with us and it will be with us until we confront it. So we've been meeting some of his supporters and trying to understand their life experience. But at this point, I'm kind of out of patience with them. Even our own warm-hearted Patty Dwyer. I mean, this guy has now bragged about routinely sexually assaulting women. WNYC's Arun Vanagopal is here with me. And Arun, you've been spending time with Patty. How can she possibly stand behind that kind of demeaning language?
Well, the first thing I heard from her was a text message. This was a couple days after the video dropped. And she writes to me, she says, "It will be what it will be. We have peace of mind knowing we did all we could."
Goodness, it sounds like a terminal illness, or really like she's giving a concession speech.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But then I called her up.
Hi, Patty. It's Arun here.
Hey, Arun there. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good, I'm good.
And eventually I asked her, "Did you see it? Did you watch it?"
Oh, yeah, I heard it.
And what did you make of it? I guess it kind of caused this huge...
I was like, oh, damn.
She found the tape unseemly, okay? But then...
We know nobody's perfect. Nobody... Here we are, a year after all this is on. This is what they pull out now, right? This is what they pull out now.
They, meaning the Clinton campaign. And she thinks this is rank hypocrisy, given how liberals reacted to the Clinton sex scandals.
I didn't say I condone that. But listen, we say that. Now, all of a sudden, this is a hypocrisy of the left to the right. We went through this for years in the 90s. And I had little children coming to visit my sons that were maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. And they were hearing from the parents, "It was only sex. It was only sex." Right? Now, we have this one little clip, 2 minutes of Donald Trump saying that, and they go ape, you know what.
For Patty, it's not just the Clintons who are to blame. It is the entire, quote-unquote, establishment.
I always knew 90% of the media were in Clinton's pocket. But now, of course, with the WikiLeaks and doing a lot of research on all that, it's quite obvious.
And by research, Patty means going on Facebook, going the internet. Media figures, whether it's Sean Hannity, Lou Dobbs, these are the people she trusts, okay? The rest, the mainstream media, if you will, can't be trusted.
So, I mean, there's no denying it, but we won't see that in the media. We'll see very little of it in the media. The American people, we the people, meaning all of us, deserve to be brought the truth, and we won't be. We will not be brought the truth.
Which means even the Billy Bush tape, it's just one big setup.
Come on. I mean, how can she make excuses for this? It sounds to me, honestly, like the irrational hatred for the Clintons will justify just about anything that Donald Trump says or does.
Well, honestly, that's part of it. You can't separate Patty's support for Trump from the fact that she really, really resents the Clintons and has for a very long time. And I noticed just how much that matters to her one night this past summer. She had me over for dinner during the Republican convention. This was in July, the night that Donald Trump spoke. We had wings and quesadillas and a nice salad.
We cannot afford to be so politically correct anymore.
Oh my gosh, it seems like I've been waiting for this since the 80s. Yeah? When the political correctness started, when Bill Clinton was, you know, with the... What is the definition of is? When, as soon as I heard that, I hear it as if I heard it yesterday. And that was the beginning of political correctness. And I'm really a little emotional.
What?
About this. To hear someone actually say things we've been saying for decades and not feeling we were heard, you know what I mean? Or nobody to speak up for us. And it's pretty amazing.
So as you can hear, this disgust for the Clintons is very deep, and it goes back a long, long way. And notably, the same people who have been nursing and stoking that outrage for years, they are now running Trump's campaign. You won't find traditional political operatives there. He is instead led by the vanguard of the right-wing media. And they have created an emotional narrative for people that is far more powerful than any set of facts. Which brings us to WNYC's Matt Katz, who has been obsessively following conservative media. Matt says everything about Trump's response to that Billy Bush video is textbook, a perfect marriage of Breitbart and its talk radio predecessors.
We want to welcome you to Washington University in St. Louis for the second presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, sponsored by the Commission on Presidential
Debates. The second debate between Trump and Clinton really crystallized the power of conservative media, including talk radio, and how it had essentially taken over this dominant wing of the Republican Party.
Whether we like it or not, and we can be very politically correct, but whether we like it or not, there is a problem. And we have to be
the
sure
topics brought up by Trump to attack Clinton may have seemed unfamiliar to many Americans, but they were taken directly from the airwaves of conservative talk radio, Fox News, and especially Breitbart.com. Clinton is the most despised Democrat ever in conservative media. They've gone after her, highlighting her scandals and alleged crimes for a quarter century. And now that she's close to finally being president, this is the final moment to stop her. And to their delight, here was an actual Republican nominee who embodies their views, finally taking the fight to Clinton herself.
You can say any way you want to say it, but Bill Clinton was abusive to women. Hillary Clinton attacked those same women and attacked them viciously.
It was a glorious moment, really, for conservative media, evidenced by how the former head of Breitbart, Steve Bannon, who is now CEO of the Trump campaign, stood at a pre-debate Trump event smirking ear to ear. Trump introduced women who had allegedly been abused by Bill Clinton. Those women are well known on the conservative airwaves.
Juanita Broderick is one of those.
Pauline Willie, Juanita Broderick.
Paula Jones.
Their names are household names among those who listen to conservative talk radio, as were the random people that Trump mentioned during the debate. He mentioned these people without full explanation, though, of who they were or are or what they had done wrong. He brought up names like Sidney Blumenthal.
The only one she talked to was Sidney Blumenthal, who's her friend and not a good guy.
Conservative media is preoccupied by Blumenthal's alleged complicity in various Clinton crimes.
Sidney Blumenthal, one of the slimy hatchet men for Hillary.
This creep Sidney Blumenthal.
Whispering in her ear all the things that she should be doing.
Trump brought up George Soros and John Gruber. These names, they were like a conglomeration of pieces of Breitbart headlines, confounding to much of America because he just mentioned them as shorthand criticism.
Many people believe it was Soros, the money changer in the temple,
who caused the 08 collapse, who is now warning that it's 08 all over again.
Even if there was some legitimacy to criticisms that Trump wanted to level against these people and their connections to Clinton, he failed to explain them on the debate stage. Because in the media bubble where he and his team live, everyone knows who Sidney Blumenthal is and why he's bad and how in the world he's connected to Benghazi, which is, by the way, a scandal that also really doesn't live beyond conservative outlets. But elsewhere in America, people don't really get it. The base, though, loved it. They loved Trump's performance and what he talked about, even if everyone else may have been confused. As the debate began, Breitbart ran a Trump ad on its website that really fit the moment. It fit how Trump had decided to ride this underdog conservative media campaign right to Election Day with none of the typical efforts to bring in new voters who don't listen to Rush Limbaugh, for example. The ad on Breitbart said, "It's us against the world."
So, Matt, one of the things I think a lot of us are trying to understand in this election and probably before that is, how is it possible that this group of people who support Donald Trump, they sound like they're doing relatively well financially. They are white people. How do they end up feeling like they are the people who are being aggrieved right now in American society? It's almost like they're in some kind of alternative universe, and I cannot wrap my head around it.
Let's for a moment go into their cars, driving home from work, and listen to Rush Limbaugh, the conservative talk radio king. I want to play a clip from the first year of the Obama presidency. And Rush Limbaugh is doing a show, and he turns on a parody song to the tune of Puff the Magic Dragon.
Barack the Magic Negro lives in D.C. The L.A. Times, they call him that 'cause he's not authentic like me.
So, wow, I cannot imagine how anybody could listen to that and think anything other than, wow, that's pretty racist. And in fact, it caused enormous controversy at the time.
That's not what the millions of conservative talk radio show listeners heard, nor, therefore, what a large swath of America heard, because what they heard was Limbaugh blasting the mainstream media. And the reason is that this parody song was created after the LA Times published a column that argued that whites liked Obama because he was non-threatening. What Rush would talk about for the weeks that this controversy raged was how the mainstream media was making this huge deal out of this little song that he had commissioned.
So suddenly it doesn't become a debate with Barack Obama. It doesn't become a debate with black people. It doesn't become a debate with those of us who are black and felt deeply offended by it. It becomes a debate with the media instead. This is sort of the escaped hatch from it being racist.
It's about how the mainstream media, which is also a stand-in for the establishment, dismisses them, ignores them, and doesn't get them, and also only listens to them out of context.
And so this is the foundation really upon which Donald Trump's campaign has been built, is that these ideas that I hear you describing, we're hearing this over and over and over again when people say, hey, you're not listening to what Donald actually has to say here.
That's right. And when you hear him rail against political correctness, which for many Americans, they thought that term had died many years ago. They didn't know that was still a thing. For conservatives who listen to talk radio, that is still very much a thing. It embodies so much of their beef with the way they perceive the direction that this country is going in. Trump may be facing off against Hillary Clinton, who has, by the way, provided fodder for talk radio for a quarter century. But at the same time, he's seen as taking the fight for the first time in a real way to this so-called mainstream media establishment.
So what are their grievances with the mainstream media? We said that their views are taken out of context so often. What else?
Part of the beef with the mainstream media is we decide the words that can be used to call black people, for example. No, now we don't call them black people. Now we call them African Americans. These things are seen as a creeping march toward fascism, toward thought control. There's a conservative talk radio host in Philadelphia, Rich Zeoli, and he and I often talk about this divide. He says that the mainstream media ignores the voices of black conservatives, for example, because we don't want to legitimize the fact that there could be blacks who have other ideas that aren't just reflexively liberal.
There is a real industry of people who go to journalism school to become journalists and then pursue this career of reporting the news. And I believe that most of them do it for ideological reasons. And that's not a bad thing. Don't misunderstand me. I think a lot of them go into journalism because they want to be Woodward and Bernstein. They want to uncover the truth. They want to be a check on the government. But because they go into it with that perspective, they are naturally bringing a bias with them.
That bias he's describing is sort of a bias to side with the underdog, which, you know, you could say is a legitimate criticism or maybe just an illegitimate analysis of journalism. The other bias, though, he says, is toward controversy, and that's probably undisputed, but he says it really harms conservatives. So he noted in a recent interview he did with Ivanka Trump where they got a little bit into the details of her father's childcare proposal. And that interview did not really make much of a ripple in the mainstream media. However, that same week, one of his colleagues, conservative talker Chris Stegall, on the same station in Philadelphia, interviewed Ivanka's brother, Donald Trump, and that caused a huge to-do in the mainstream media because Donald Trump Jr. seemed to make a Holocaust reference.
The media has built her up. They've let her slide on every, you know, indiscrepancy, on every lie, on every DNC game trying to get Bernie Sanders out of the thing. I mean, if Republicans were doing that, they'd be warming up the gas chamber right now.
There you have him again, trashing the mainstream media for supposedly being in the bag for the Democrat, but also making what to others might seem like a very insensitive and possibly anti-Semitic remark, talking about the media, which is often criticized by anti-Semitic Trump supporters as being dominated by Jews. So this did get a good deal of coverage from the mainstream media for a couple of days, and that really bothered Rich Scioli.
That became the story for 2 days of the cycle. And who can you blame for that but the mainstream media for focusing on a comment like that and then blowing it up in such a degree and ignoring a very substantive interview with his sister who's talking about actual policy?
What does Scioli say to the fact that for many people, it is also a substantive problem and a substantive story if someone is making Holocaust references towards anybody?
I can't speak for him directly on that, but I will tell you that these talk show hosts are provocateurs, obviously, but they really despise mainstream media's role as the guardians of political correctness. And they think that jokes are turned into controversies in order to provide political cover for Democrats. Limbaugh calls us, by the way, drive-bys. As in drive-by shooters, because we don't listen to conservatives within context. We just hear a parody song like Barack the Magic Negro or some sort of offhanded comment about a gas chamber, which, for the record, Donald Trump Jr. said was referring to the use of a gas chambers in America for capital punishment purposes, not to exterminate millions of people.
Not for nothing, the drive-by shooting reference is troubling to me as well. And, you know, this is the thing is, they stack up a lot of this. Some of us feel like where there's smoke, there's fire. There are a great many of these controversies to be had.
There are many instances, and I have a bunch here of Rush Limbaugh talking about race in ways that frankly make me feel uncomfortable. Here's him disparaging the slaughter, for example, of Native Americans.
And what is the Holocaust? 90 million Indians? Only 4 million left? They all have casinos. What's to complain about?
He once made a slavery joke while musing about the possibility of former New York Governor David Patterson, who is black, appointing someone to replace Congressman Eric Massa.
So David Patterson will become the Massa,
yes,
who gets to appoint whoever gets to take Massa's place. So for the first time in his life, Patterson's going to be a Massa. Interesting. Interesting.
I don't even know what to do with that. I don't even know how to respond to that. That, I mean, this is the kind of thing. It piles up and piles up. And for those of us who are on the receiving end of these jokes, it starts to feel like they've got frankly, an obsession with race.
See, they say that the other side is obsessed with race. They say that with a black president and a black attorney general and a Latina on the Supreme Court, racism doesn't exist the way liberals and Al Sharpton and Black Lives Matter and the mainstream media wants us to believe. So they see speeches about black people getting shot by cops or policies of affirmative action and education as just a craven way to get black people to vote Democratic.
The days of them not having any power are over, and they are angry, and they want to use their power as a means of retribution. That's what Obama's about, gang. He's angry. He's going to cut this country down to size. He's going to make it pay for all this multicultural mistakes that it has made.
And what I hear in that is, ironically, an identity politic. He has created this world in which where you can go and you can develop a racial identity that is shared, that feels aggrieved. All the things that he's blaming people of color and liberals for, they are doing in this space.
Right. His listeners see a rapidly changing America. Maybe they worked at a plant that moved to Mexico, for example, and that one perhaps isolated incident can be put into larger context and given greater meaning when Limbaugh explains that there are larger forces going on that are trying to change the America that his listeners grew up in.
Which again brings us back to actual events that occur and people in this identity politic and in this land have a whole different set of facts and understanding about the things that actually happened than other people in the country have.
That's right. And often those facts are incorrect and often they are conspiracy theories. Last year, this is one example that didn't get much attention and it's not incredibly outrageous, but I think it serves to illustrate something. Last year, Limbaugh chided Michelle Obama. He calls her Michelle Obama. I'm not sure why. For a speech she gave at the opening of the new Whitney Museum in New York City.
She said museums and concert halls just don't welcome non-white visitors, especially children, the way they welcome white people.
A little bit more from this. Limbaugh said the First Lady was acting as an aggrieved victim.
Everything has to be about race with these people. And, we were supposed to be post-racial with the election of Obama. We're supposed to have put all that behind us. His election was supposed to mean something. It was supposed to signify that we had overcome and gotten past the original sin of slavery. And instead, as I knew would be the case, it's gotten worse by design.
He went on to say that maybe black people don't go to museums because it's not in their cultural upbringing, because maybe they think it's too white. You know, the problem here is that I looked up what Michelle Obama said.
There are so many kids in this country who look at places like museums and concert halls and other cultural centers, and they think to themselves, well, that's not a place for me.
And she made no broad statement about white people. She never mentioned race. Instead, she talked about poor kids not having access to museums.
But Limbaugh heard race, even though she never said it.
And then he grossly misquoted her. It's one of many conspiracy theories, allegations that float around on talk radio and that really seeps into the consciousness of many Americans. And that includes the slander that the president is a Kenyan Muslim. To the allegation that I've heard so often through the years that the government, the federal government, gives free cell phones to poor people. When you defame the media as being filled with liberal liars, which is what talk radio has done very successfully, anything you say to replace their assertions flies as fact. And certainly through the years, the media has gotten it wrong. And certainly you can make an argument that there are too many left-leaning people in the media. I've seen surveys that show that most reporters are liberal, and that's, you can assert that. But the blanket defamation of all mainstream media, whatever that might be, as being bogus, creates a space where this stuff can grow. And a lot of the conspiracy, a lot of it deals with race. This goes further. Limbaugh said a couple of years ago that he wouldn't be surprised if Obama instigated race riots.
Because that's part of the program here. And next up, there are going to be race riots, I guarantee. And the race riots are part of the plan that this regime has. That's next.
Glenn Beck, another conservative talk radio powerhouse, he has suggested something similar.
I told you over a year ago that the only thing this president would have left in the end was race. That's all he would have. And they would do everything they could to start race riots because it's what the Weather Underground said they wanted.
So when you start to hear some of that, you get an understanding of, well, maybe not an understanding, but you can see the path that people have walked along to get them to see Black Lives Matter protests as violent, deliberate riots that the liberals and Obama in particular have encouraged.
That's right. But talk radio isn't alone in this anymore. 20 years ago, a political operative named Roger Ailes founded Fox News and turned it into not only the most watched cable news station in the country, but also the biggest microphone in conservative America. Fox became the driving force behind Republican foreign and domestic policy. Like talk radio, it wraps itself in traditional American values, and like talk radio, it doesn't always propagate in facts. Ailes gave businessman Donald Trump for several years a weekly slot on the show Fox and Friends, the morning show, where Trump talked up his concern of a phenomenon that we now know as birtherism.
He could have been born outside of this country. Why can't he produce a birth certificate? And by the way, there's one story that his family doesn't even know what hospital he was born in.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Donald, before you go, what about the mainstream media accounts of this dust up over the last week where they're trying to paint you as, you know, the mayor of Crazy Town for bringing this up?
Every time I talk about the birthers, I start off by saying, and it's very interesting, I was a great student at the best college in the country. You know, I want to let people know I'm a smart guy.
Roger Ailes is gone from Fox News now, and in fact has joined the Trump campaign. And in many ways, his campaign is just an outlet for conservative media.
Absolutely. And then you think about what Trump's top issue is and what he has centered his campaign on, and that's immigration. And the rhetoric is so similar to the heated rhetoric we've heard on conservative talk radio through the years regarding immigration. Here's talk radio personality Michael Savage, who argued that tanks should be on the border and that immigrants bring in epidemics like bed bugs.
How is it that for decades there were no bed bugs to speak of in New York City or anywhere else in America? And where did this epidemic suddenly come from? Is it a result of massive, massive waves of immigration from the third world?
I guess, again, the facts aren't really at issue here. It's much more about being inside a certain kind of aggrieved identity group. That's really what's happening here, is that they're building a narrative where you're part of this group, you've been left out, and you need to be concerned about that moving forward.
There was a moment this summer, I was listening to Rush, and he really crystallized what this is all about in very similar words to the ones you just used.
No matter where you turn, you can't escape this fact. If you are conservative, Republican, straight, and white, you are yesterday. You are so yesterday. You are so irrelevant. You are so unnecessary.
The country is being taken from them, and we need to make America great again.
But all of this, the alternative reality in which white conservatives are an endangered species, the belief that Democrats are inciting race wars, the notion that immigrants are violent, diseased invaders, and even this week, Trump's continued insistence that five black boys who were long ago exonerated for a wrongful conviction of rape in Central Park are in fact still guilty. All of it, it adds up. And some say it has consequences that go way, way past words and jokes. That's after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So back to Long Island. Long before Donald Trump adopted an amplified rhetoric like the stuff we heard before the break, it was very much a part of the political discourse on Long Island. As we've said, the Long Island suburbs have been enmeshed in immigration culture wars for some time. And for a lot of people, it came to a head just before midnight on November 8th, 2008. The Nation's Julianne Hing has the story.
November 8th, 2008 was a major moment for immigration politics on Long Island. But to understand that day, we need to back up even more, to 2001. George W. Bush was president, and Long Island was just starting to feel the shifts of its changing racial makeup.
This is a once-in-a-lifetime event that you can get a bunch of superstars of this caliber together.
And one of those superstars the announcer was talking about was Glenn Spencer. He appeared in front of a citizens group called Sachem Quality of Life, who were concerned about a large influx of Latino immigrants in Suffolk County. Spencer's a leader in the anti-immigration movement and a frequent guest on conservative talk radio and Fox News.
There's a videotape, we showed it on our website, AmericanPatrol.com and AmericanBorderPatrol.com, of the Mexican army herding 100 people up to our border for a border crossing.
Here's a taste of his rhetoric on Fox in 2003.
Now let's understand something. Here, we're fighting possibly a war halfway around the world against Iraq. Iraq is not a direct threat to us. But a recent poll showed that the vast majority of Mexicans believe the Southwest belongs to them.
Now, as we've reported, by and large, blacks and whites did not live next to each other on Long Island. The towns were purposely racially segregated as the suburbs were developed. But new Latino immigrants found housing where they could. Pat Young is an immigration attorney with CORESAN, the Central American Refugee Center.
They moved into neighborhoods where they were the first non-white people because they didn't know the rules.
And to save on rent, immigrants roomed together. In the early 2000s, complaints about homes overstuffed with immigrants melded in with anger about day laborers who waited for work outside Home Depots and 7-Elevens. Every morning, contractors would pick up men to take them to tend Long Islanders' lawns and gardens or to fix their homes. The pushback made its way into the political mainstream. Steve Levy, Suffolk County's popular county executive from 2004 to 2011, took up the mantle to fight against undocumented immigrants. In Levy's mind, immigration is all about respecting the law. When we talked this summer, he insisted he welcomes authorized immigration.
The only thing we point out is that we want people to wait online and play by the rules.
And an aside, for more on the idea that immigrants should wait in line, check out episode 3 of this podcast. As county executive, Levy backed apartment raids to investigate suspected housing code violations. He wanted to turn local police into immigration agents. Before he assumed office, he opposed a hiring center for day laborers, which would get them indoors and off of sidewalks. There was certainly a feeling that immigrants just didn't belong.
This is Bay Avenue. So this is the house my brother used to live in, on the second floor.
At the time, Josello Lucero was aware of the local politics. He lived in Patchogue, and he knew that Latinos were often violently harassed. People would throw bottles at them from their cars or drive up onto a sidewalk where day laborers were standing to try to run them over. Mainly, Josello knew about this because his big brother, Marcelo, who lived two doors away, hounded him to be watchful.
You know, you got to stay out of trouble. You know, I don't want you to be in the street. You know how it is. You know, he was always concerned.
But Josello wasn't afraid. Marcelo was the first in the family to set out for the U.S. from Ecuador, and Josello followed a few years after. The brothers led quiet lives. They worked full-time jobs, played volleyball at night with friends, went to church. Marcelo was always careful about his appearance, and he tried to get Josello to care, too.
Because he used to work in a dry cleaner, right? So he knows all the material, the clothes and things like that, you know, she told you, like, this is bad, you know, this is not cotton, this is not this. It's like, I mean, like, I'm saying, who cares? You know, I was just like, no, he was totally different. He was like classy guy, you know, he likes wear his clothes, knead, iron.
Between Marcelo's work at the dry cleaners and his own job as a welder, Josello felt like they were a class apart from the day laborers everyone made so much of a fuss about. And then one Saturday morning, a woman in a police uniform knocked on his door.
And say, you related with Marcelo? I say, yes. And say, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, but your brother was killed last night.
It was November 8th, 2008. Marcelo had been walking with a friend named Angel Loja when they rounded a corner behind the Patchogue Long Island Railroad Station. According to Loja's testimony in court, teenagers, seven of them, set upon the two Ecuadorian men with the intent of robbing them.
And they started, using racial slurs, racial words against them, you know, like, you know, you beaners, you come to steal our money from my country. And, you know, they think they have the right to say whatever they want. And then my brother told him, like, you know, I'm not going to give you any money.
Angel and Marcelo were outnumbered.
And one of them punched his friend and the other one punched my brother.
Angel tried to call 911, but his cell phone died and he ran to get help. Marcelo was by himself now.
My brother took his bell and started swinging around them. You know, everybody started gathering. Go around him, and he was defending with his belt. And the time he was swinging, he hit one of the guys, and he gets more angry where he was before because he don't get what he wants. And he walked behind him like a coward and stabbed him twice.
Marcelo died later that night. He was 37. Today, Josello is the outreach coordinator for the Hagedorn Foundation. They're a private family philanthropic group that supports immigration services. He says he never set out to lead a political or public life.
I'm a regular guy like everybody else.
And now he's more or less a professional public speaker. Here he is speaking last month at WNYC's launch of the United States of Anxiety at Adelphi University.
Media and politicians have a lot of power. When, you know, you have a kid, they listen and listen to the radio or watch the TV, and every politician blames immigrants to come to this country and sell drugs or stealing the jobs. It's no relation with that. You know, but what happens is the kids or people being absorbed in negativity about immigrants, sometimes they want to take it to their own hands. In the case of my brother, that happens.
Rush Limbaugh says, if you're white and conservative, you're yesterday. Well, next week, we look at the white identity crisis up close.
The United States of Anxiety is produced by WNYC Studios and The Nation magazine. Reporting this week by Arun Venugopal, Julianne Hing, and Matt Katz, and produced by myself, Joseph Capriglione. It's recorded and mixed by Bill Moss and Casey Means. Our theme music is by Nathan Halpern. Special thanks to our digital team, Lee Hill and Alex Kahn. Karen Frillman is our editor and executive producer, along with Kai Wright.
That was episode 4 of the WNYC series, The United States of Anxiety. To hear the first 3 in the series and to make sure you don't miss the next 4, go to iTunes and subscribe to The United States of Anxiety. I'm Brooke Gladstone.